You're listening to the Dismantling Normal podcast. I'm Megan Schaefer, and when my perfectly curated normal life blew up and took my standard list of checkboxes with it, I reevaluated everything. I stopped hustling for my worth and found freedom in coloring outside the lines. Join me for authentic, curious conversations that unravel the baggage, bias, and distance our perceptions of normal create. Let's find out what happens when we stop being normal and start being real. Hello and welcome to Dismantling Normal. This week I'm chatting with Wayne. So I met Wayne on another podcast I produce, which is why I'm already familiar with some of his stories. Wayne is somebody I could sit and listen to tell stories all day, and he has a lot of them, which is why I was really excited to be able to, monopolize his attention for a little while so I could hear his stories. I asked Wayne to be on the podcast for two reasons. First of all, some of you know, I've had a notoriously rough road when it came to deciding what and who I wanted to be when I grew up. Who are we kidding? I'm still figuring all of that out. But when I was younger, there were a lot of sharp right turns. My degree is in exercise science. I've been licensed in real estate, aesthetics, personal training. However, the job I've always gotten paid to do was in marketing. I know. It all makes perfect sense. But there were phases of my career when I was so miserable and I was really hardcore searching for that thing. And I became really interested in what people did for a living. I would kind of interview them both formally and informally, but I wasn't so much looking for the facts. I was looking for the story. I wanted to hear something interesting. I wanted to hear what they loved. I was watching their body language and the tone of their voice, and I wanted to see if they were passionate about what they did and what brought them there. You kind of like Gina from episode 13. So when I met Wayne and he described himself as a serial entrepreneur, my old curiosity was totally piqued because that was interesting to me. I mean, what exactly does that mean? What does it entail? How does one become a serial entrepreneur? So we talk all about Wayne's road to getting there, from the teacher that changed his trajectory in fifth grade to the businesses he's involved in today. In the other part of this conversation, Wayne and I talk about race. Wayne has seen a lot of change. I'm not saying that you're old Wayne, just that you've seen a lot of change. And I often hear people fall back on the idea or the question of, well, haven't things gotten so much better? So I wanted to hear Wayne's take on it. Wayne also shares some really impactful analogies, and I so appreciated his willingness to share and have this conversation with me. I mean, really, that's what it's all about. That's why I started this podcast, to bring things to the surface, to have the discussions that make us uncomfortable, to create a better foundation for understanding. Okay, let's get to it. Okay, we're good. All right, well, has anything new and exciting happened to you since last time we talked?
You know, I guess that depends on what you call new and exciting. But first of all, thanks so very much for the opportunity to connect with you and talk again. I always enjoy a conversation, so I'm really looking forward to this one. I guess I'd say in the area of exciting, business is picking up, and I think that's exciting. So
I would
that's
agree.
A great thing.
Absolutely. Well, look at this. You're like segueing perfectly for me. When I read your bio, you called yourself a serial entrepreneur. And I loved that. And I was so curious about kind of your road to getting there, for one. And for two, you mentioned some stories and some other analogies that I've just found really interesting that you'd come up with that I wanted to talk to you about too. So Thank you so much for being here. As far as your kind of path to serial entrepreneurship, I guess I'm curious. I know so little about you. I know you live in Indiana now. Is that where you grew up?
That is not. I got to Indiana by somewhat of a standard routine. I actually family's from Texas originally, but I grew up mostly in Chicago.
Okay.
And ended up going to Rolls-Hulman for my undergraduate education.
Yeah.
And while at Rolls-Hulman, I met my wife. And that is primarily why we ended up back here in Indianapolis, because her family was from here. And we wanted to be here where we were close to her family with grandma and grandpa and babysitters and all of that for family.
Mm-hmm.
So it has kind of worked out really well. But in between there, after Rolls-Hulman, I spent time in the military and lived in St. Louis and lived in New York and lived in Europe. And we ended up back here in Indianapolis and have been here pretty much ever since.
Oh, gosh. Well, going back to when you were younger, did you have an idea like of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I did. Like most of us, I have not necessarily ended up right where I thought I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought I knew where I wanted to go. And that's why I ended up going to Rolls-Hulman, because growing mm-hmm. up, I, for some reason, I wanted to be an electrical engineer. And I had met a guy who was an electrical engineer, and I thought he had the greatest job. And so I decided that's what I wanted to be. And that was kind of where I was pointing and heading through most of my educational life. And that was very, very early on in my life. I was in, second or third grade when I decided that thing.
Well, and what was it about his job that you thought was just the greatest job?
Well, I thought it was really neat for a lot of reasons, because I'm old enough that a lot of things like, and this will really tell you my age, transistor radios and televisions and those kind of things were brand new things. And I thought it was really exciting that this guy had a job where he worked on things like that.
Yeah.
In the organization he worked for was Texas Instruments, TI.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I had their calculators.
Exactly where I was going. And he worked on calculators. And I thought that was just so cool that this guy got to work on those things like that, that I knew what they were. And I thought they were such cool devices. So I thought, well, it'd be really great to do like him and work on those things.
Well, I'll date myself. I mean, those calculators were like, they came out with the ones with all of the buttons that did all of the things.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the, I can't even remember what they're called, but that's what we had to have for math class to do the, so we didn't have to memorize all the formulas because they had all the buttons.
Yep. Well, I'll go you one better than that. And you may not even have heard of them or ever seen them. But I grew up using slide rules.
So. Okay, yes. You won up in a big way.
Yeah, I mean, I used to be able to make a slide rule kind of sing. So.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, yeah, I'm an old guy. I'm an old guy. But, yeah, I wanted to be an engineer. Didn't necessarily know that I wanted to go to Rolls-Hulman. It's an interesting story. I got there too, but I always knew or thought I wanted to be an engineer.
Yeah. And then that got you to Rolls-Hulman. So when you were in middle school, high school, you kept that mm-hmm. vision the whole time. That's what you wanted to do.
Absolutely. And I have to tell you this story. You know, I like to tell stories.
I do. One That's of the why folks, I wanted to talk to you.
Yes. But one of the people who had the most impact on my life was my fourth grade teacher. Ruth Gans was her name. I will remember that lady until I don't remember anyone else.
Oh.
And because I thought I wanted to be an engineer,
mm-hmm.
I didn't think I needed to know English and grammar and know how to write and all those kinds of things. And I just was focused on math and science and all of that. And for some reason, she took a liking to me, and she probably couldn't do something like this today, but she pulled me aside and had me stay after school one day and asked me why it was that I was so good in math and science and all of those things, but I was just horrible in English and grammar and all of that. And she said she thought it looked like I just wasn't really trying. And I said, you're right. I really don't care about those things because I'm going to be an engineer. And she got this look on her face and she looked at me and she said, you know what? You are just stupid. I said, what? She said, you're going to need to be able to communicate and read and write and understand grammar and know all those things no matter what you do. And in fact, those are going to be the most important thing for you in your career. And you know what? She made me stay after school with her and she tutored me every day for the rest of the year in English and grammar and all of those kinds of things, and caught me up and got me to the point where I knew what I was doing. And she was right. Communication, being able to write, being able to talk, knowing grammar have been one of the most important skill sets and capabilities I've had in my entire career. So if I could find her, I actually did try to go back and find her one day, but I could not find her. I wanted to go back and thank her and say, ma'am, you just have no idea what you did for me.
Well, yeah, those people in our lives are just incredible. Now, as a young man, did you begrudgingly do it? Did you, or did you believe her? And then you were grateful for her then? Or is it more really when you look back?
It's when I look back, because back then I thought she was punishing me by making me stay after school every day.
I can only imagine. Oh my
but, goodness. You know, looking back, I am so thankful and happy that she did that. I owe her an amazing, serious debt of gratitude. So, Ruth Gans, wherever you are, thank you so much.
What a great memory. Oh, yeah. My goodness. So she got you caught up, and that's what one of my questions was going to be, was whether or not you were a good student. You thought of yourself as a good student. I know Rose Holman is a very good school, so I know that you had to be, you know, of a certain level to even get in there, but I didn't know if learning was something you loved or if learning was something that you just kind of endured to get where you wanted to go.
I loved learning. I loved reading. I still read. People used to think I was insane because I would go to the library and I read the encyclopedias from A to Z.
Oh my goodness.
So I have a tremendous amount of just innocuous, miscellaneous, why would you know that information in my head.
I love that. I can only imagine what you did when the internet became so
Oh my goodness,
yeah. That must have just sent you on a tailspin.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love to read. I love to learn. At any given time, I'm probably reading 3 or 4 different books. At any given time, I'm taking some class or some seminar here. For me, learning is a continuous process, and there is always more that you can learn, and you can never know enough. And that was something that my parents instilled in me. My mother was a teacher, and she drilled that into us, that once you get it in your head, nobody can take it away from you.
That's awesome.
Yes, it is.
How old were you then when that was happening and you were realizing you needed to catch up in English and communication?
I was in 4th grade when she told me that, and I kind of got started. But I was probably in high school before I really realized the value and what it meant and just what an impact it was going to have for me. And honestly, there was a period of time where I really thought that I was going to shift gears and go more into a liberal arts vein. And in fact, at Rose Holman, I at one point was taking so many elective courses in philosophy and sociology and literature and those kinds of things that they wondered, are you still an engineering major? So I caught that fever and that fire somewhere, and I'm glad that I did. It has been invaluable to me.
Yeah. So you moved through high school and then you got into Rose Holman. And actually, if you don't mind my asking, you talked about an experience on day one at Rose Hillman. Do you mind recounting that experience?
Absolutely not. And I'll tell you the story of how I got to Rose Hillman. I worked for Kemper Insurance in the summer between my junior and senior year in high school as a summer job. Mm-hmm. I got really fortunate and got a job there. And they had what they called the Kemper Scholars Program, right? Mm. And they had a relationship with Rose Hillman. And I was looking at schools, and Rose Hillman and Kemper gave me enough scholarship that I was not going to have to pay anything, or more accurately, my father was not going to have to pay anything. And my father sat me down one day and said, "You know where you're going, right?" And I said, "No, not yet." And he said, "Yes, you do. You're going to Rose Hillman." And that I get it now. I didn't understand it at the time. And I'll be honest, going to Rose Hillman has turned out to be one of the most positive influences on my life, and what I will call right again by dumb luck. Because I really didn't know what I was really getting into and the value of the education and mm-hmm. the relationships that I was going to get there. But my first day of school, my dad and I drove down from Chicago to Terre Haute, and we walked into my dorm room. And this is many, many, many years ago. We're talking, gosh, close to 45 years now. And when we walked in, my roommate and his mother and father were already in the room, and his mother was sitting on his bed. And when my dad and I walked into the room, the mother, I swear, levitated across the room without touching the floor and hid behind her husband. And looked at her son and said, "Grab your bags. You're leaving. You're not rooming with Ian." And so I ended up with no roommate. Ultimately, her son and I actually ended up being fairly, really decent friends.
Yeah. It's not a very big school.
It is not. It is not. I was the only one in my class, by the way. Yeah. The only black person in my class. Gosh, at the time there were maybe 5 black students in the entire school.
Now, was that the first time you had experienced anything like that? Or
oh, absolutely.
Okay.
No doubt. No doubt. For me, it was like cultural immersion. And it's another one of the right again by dumb luck things that happened to me. Mm-hmm. Because I grew up in a segregated environment and community, and had not gone to school with anyone other than black people. So it was really hard for me because I was a fish out of water.
Sure.
The culture, particularly back then, I don't think it would be as stark now as it was then, but the cultures were so radically different. We listened to different music. We read different things. We talked about different things. It was a totally different world, and I really had a really, really tough time learning how to acclimate and understand how to develop and form relationships and survive in that environment. But, you know, you adapt and you do what you have to.
You do, but that is a very precarious time to be learning all of that all at once. I mean, leaving home and going to college all in of itself is a lot to handle. And you're so young. You know, you feel old when you're doing it. You feel like it's my time, I'm doing it. But you're really so mm-hmm. young. And then all to layer all of that on is just quite a bit.
Absolutely. And in fact, after 2 weeks, I called my dad and said, "Dad, I can't do this. I'm coming
mm-hmm.
home."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, you can leave there, but you can't come home." And I'm like, "Oh, I guess I'm staying." My dad had a standard speech for us when we graduated from high school. "I don't know where you're going when you cross that stage, but I assure you, it is not back home to my house. So you better know what you're doing."
And you said us. Did you have siblings?
I have four. Well, actually five, because there were five biological brothers, and then a sixth brother that my parents adopted, in quotes, because he lived next door to us and had no family, and his grandmother passed, and they adopted him. So there ended up being six of us, but I was right in the middle of the biological sons.
Oh, gotcha. Yes, you were the middle kid.
I was the middle kid, absolutely. So
I was for a long time, too. I get it.
All right. Okay. So, well, then we got something else in common. Maybe that's why we get along so well.
Maybe.
Absolutely. Okay.
So but during that time, you're going through all of this, you meet your wife. You mentioned that. That's where you met your wife.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you just meet her? Did you have a class with her? Did you meet her at a party?
Another good story. You keep
I
hitting
love
them all.
How you meet stories. I love, love, love them.
I was actually dating her roommate.
Oh my goodness.
And her roommate asked me to help her because she was having trouble with her chemistry class. Okay. And so I went over to the dorm. She went to St. Mary the Woods to meet her. And when I walked in, she was sitting on the steps. And I remember very, very well because she was wearing a green miniskirt, a green sweater, and black knee-high boots.
That is some memory.
Oh, yeah. Well, it implanted, right? And so when she stood up and walked over to me, I looked at her. I said, "That's the one."
I knew, just love the first sight thing. Okay,
I knew absolutely. So I met her through her roommate, and we all actually ended up still being really good friends. So we wasn't like that. And her roommate and I weren't really serious. We were just going out and having fun and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. And then you mentioned after you graduated, and if there's anything significant in between, if I'm hopping around too far in advance,
no, please
stop me. But you mentioned living in Europe.
Yeah. So when I graduated, I went to work for Pittsburgh Plate Glass in Crystal City in Festus, Missouri, works number 9.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got drafted. And when I got drafted, I went into the military and did the first piece of my military time in Vietnam. And when I got out of that, they sent me to Europe, and I had 7 months left on my time there.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent me to a hospital. And when I got to the hospital, the commanding officer of the hospital, Major Alejandro Velez, he and I became good friends, and we used to get together, gosh, for 10 or 15 years or so after I got out of the military, we'd still get together a couple times a year and do what we call drink beer and tell lies. But Alejandro looked at me and said, "What am I doing with an infantry man at a hospital?" Because I'm just coming from Nam, right? And he says, "I don't need an infantry man at a hospital." It was in Landstuhl, Germany, which is the headquarters for the U.S. military in Europe. And there's a big hospital there. And when you hear them medevacing people from anywhere in the world from a combat zone with major traumatic injuries, that's where they're going.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So he says, "But I see you have a degree in engineering. I have these new things called computers. So you're the computer guy." And that's how I got into computers. I liked it. I loved it. Really. They literally sat me in a room with the computer and the manuals and said, "Figure it out." And I did. And I loved it. And so I stuck with it and have been there ever since. Came back. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I heard you say this in the first podcast you were on, and I've heard you say this in our conversation today, how much you kind of have really always leaned into happy accidents in your life. You even have alluded to the fact that you didn't end up with a roommate worked out better for you. You're talking about someone just sitting you in front of a computer and that ended up working out. Is this kind of how it just kept going for you in terms of just happy accident, one right after the other?
Well, you know, that's a lot of life. Mm-hmm. I call it luck, timing, and serendipity. But then you also start planning and trying to do some things. along with it. But along the lines of the question you asked there, one of the happy accidents, and I said I'd talk about that in going to Rose-Hulman, was that going to Rose-Hulman and going through that transition earlier than later, I was adjusted to and knew how to get along in the larger majority community. Mm-hmm. And that's something that a lot of folks coming from my background struggle with and have problems with. And it's not that they are not, you know, technically capable or competent. It is the soft side, the social side, the interaction, the relationships, the connectivities that they have issues and problems with. And I had worked through all of that in college and was very comfortable and adjusted and knew how to work and find my way in the majority community. And then in addition to that, later on, another happy accident, to your point, when I started my business, a lot of the folks that I went to Rose-Hulman with were now at a stage and a point in their career that they were the folks that I needed to talk to about doing business. And we already had a relationship. We already knew each other. We were already comfortable with each other. We already had trust. And so right again, by dumb luck, it was absolutely one of the best and most important things that happened to me in terms of my success.
So you started your own business. How long after you worked on the computers in the hospital did you start your own business?
So I came back, and I went to work for American States Insurance, which was sold to Safeco. Mm-hmm. And while I was working there, we got sold to Safeco. And you know how those things happen when there's a event like that, you move on. Okay.
Right.
And I got a job with a guy by the name of Chris McAvoy. And Chris is one of the, I think, most overlooked and important pieces of the local IT community, particularly startup community, that's out there. He had a company called Palm, and that stood for Packaged Automated Life and Liability Management Systems. Any rate, it was a startup company. I joined his company, became his director of consulting. The company was very successful, and Chris did well enough on the sale of the company that he didn't work again. He tried another startup. That one did not go quite as well, but he taught classes at Purdue in their entrepreneurial program. But he was one of the very first early IT successes here that doesn't ever get mentioned and talked about, because we sold Palm in the early to mid-90s.
Hmm.
So that was my introduction to the startup world.
Okay.
So then when I left Palm, I liked the pattern and I saw what was going on. And I said, oh, this is nice. I need to figure out how to do this again.
Well, it takes a special mentality for the startup world, I think. You got to kind of love it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you do. Yeah. Yes, you do. And that's just like everything else. If you don't have the right mentality for whatever that is, you're probably better off not trying to do it.
Sure.
And so I started my first startup consulting company, but we did pretty well, really well. And we grew that and sold that company. And this time, because it was my company, I got the proceeds, and that was a good thing. And I'm not saying that, you know, anything was wrong with the first one. It was Chris's company. He's the guy who should have got the money. And
sure.
That's fine. Yeah.
Sure.
So then I started a second company, which did not go quite as well.
When it's your company, you assume the risk.
Absolutely. We took Great Plains accounting system. And actually, Microsoft has done it with Dynamics. We took an accounting system, a GL system, and wrote inventory control warehouse management software around it. But we did well until IBM came along with two systems called BPIX and MAPIX, and that put us out. We couldn't compete.
Yeah.
So then I started my last IT company, And that was a recruiting and staffing and consulting company. And I sold that one 5 years ago to a local company here, Smart IT, now OneBridge. Paul Rothwell and Karen Cooper are the owners. And I think they're one of the best kept hidden secrets going on here. They have a very, very successful recruiting, staffing, consulting company, and are doing some really, really great things. So those were my three IT forays.
And what do you think, you know, we talked about it being, there's a special mentality, there's a special kind of love for startups. What do you think it was about those that were so alluring? Because it sounds like you started them knowing you were building them to sell them. And that's different. There's building a business to build a business in a long, you know, with longevity. And there's building a business to sell it off.
Right. Right. You're absolutely right.
Like brought you to this. What do you think was the allure for you?
Well, again, I think it was because of the experience with Chris McAvoy, and I mm-hmm. saw how well that did for him, and I wanted to try to repeat that process and do that yeah. same thing all over again, and kind of, you know, wash, rinse, and repeat. And so I wanted to repeat that experience. And you're absolutely right. The approach and how you go at it is totally different if you're building for the long haul versus trying to build it and sell it. So, yeah. But it was seeing that positive experience and knowing what the potential outcome was. So one of the other things that I did that I don't know that we've talked about and then you may not be aware of, my brother and I, went a completely and totally different direction. And we had the local ownership rights for the Marco's Pizza territory for Central Indiana.
Oh.
And so we grew and owned and franchised pizza restaurants. And we did that for 7 years. And then we sold that territory to a local guy, Brandon Gorin, who's an ex-NFL football player, Purdue guy. And he still has the territory today.
But now, did you feel like, have you gotten to the point where it doesn't matter if it's IT or it's pizza or it's this widget or that gadget, that the formula is the formula is the formula?
You know, to some degree that is true. But mm-hmm. in the case of us going into the pizza franchise business, had a little bit of an advantage I didn't tell you about there, which is that my brother had been a very successful McDonald's franchisee.
Oh, okay.
And he had 1.7 restaurants. So we were leveraging and trading upon his knowledge and insight and awareness of the franchise world and the franchise game and the franchise business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But you are correct. The formula is the formula. There are always the nuances around a particular industry. And certainly I don't know everything. This is just my opinion, but there are always the, you know, nuances around a particular industry, but the principles of business are still pretty much the same and pretty well consistent across all industries.
Got it.
So
okay.
If you're, and that goes back to what you said earlier, if you're willing to listen and learn, you can figure it out.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the last company or the last interest you bought into?
Yeah, me individually. But what I've been doing is I've been doing angel investing and advising. And actually the company that I'm working with right now, AIS, which is owned mm-hmm. by Lamont Hatcher.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working with him and advising him and helping him on the path to grow his organization and try to scale it. I'm really excited and happy to be working with Lamont and his team because I really like what they're doing and what he has been able to do. He's a really sharp guy and a really, what's the right words, intuitive guy. Back to your question earlier,
mm-hmm.
he's kind of got that innate business common sense acumen awareness that helps you a whole bunch.
Yeah, he just has the mind for it.
Yeah, he's got the right mind for it. He's going to really do some good things. So look for that one to be a really good one.
I think the other thing that I find well, part of my fascination with the whole serial entrepreneur, one, I don't have the mind for it. I always want to learn things that I know that I are just not my strong suit. But I also feel like to listen to you talk about the things that you've done and the things that you are interested in and having the, I think it, doing things the way that you want to, it kind of brings you a sense of freedom.
Yes.
That you are able to pick the projects that you want to be involved in and back the companies you want to be backing. And I just find that flows a little bit more, it has a little more fluidity with your life.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of becomes who you are and what you do become one rather than trying to separate. Well, that's what I do. That's not who I am.
Yes. Yes. That's absolutely true. That is absolutely true. And you have to really love it, and to your earlier point, because if you don't love it, you shouldn't do it. And that's, I think, true of most things in life. You got to really love it and really like it if you're going to put in the time and the effort it's going to take to make anything successful. Because no matter what you do, if you look at it as a job and an 8-to-5, you're probably not going to have the kind of success that you're looking for. It takes a lot more effort, a lot more time, and a lot more dedication and focus and input than the 8-to-5.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know that. And I know I'm preaching to the choir, but yeah.
Well, I'm just thinking at the same time, I mean, about jobs that I have had and things that I am willing to put extra effort in. And you're right. I mean, where your energy flows is kind of where the, and the amount to which you are willing to put the energy in is similar to the degree and success level.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. But I think all of us in our own way decide, you know, what's that right level and what's the right thing for us. And I think that's what's important, is what's the right thing for you.
That's fair. I like that. I like that a lot. So whenever I talked to you about being on, there were two other things that I, and this is kind of going back to your experience, your freshman year, the first day at Rose Holman. And I was hoping you would, I don't know if you've been asked to share this analogy 100 times, so you might get messy. But the reason I liked the analogy so much is as you were saying it and as I was listening to you, I could feel physically my body tense while you were talking. And it's just something where I think the analogy about living as a Black man in America is, and it's the first time someone has ever been able to explain it. I'll never know, obviously, but it is the first time I've ever had someone explain it in a way that I could feel my body change and stiffen and the anxiety kind of build. So I was hoping that you would share that.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, I'll never know what it's like to be a woman and understand what you go through. So there is that. But I'd like to share the analogy. And if we have time, there's another one I'd like to tell as well. But
sure.
What it illustrates to me is this. When I was working in Crystal City in Festus, Missouri, for Pittsburgh Plate Glass before going into the Army, there was a guy there who I got to know. And to the outside person, you would never have thought that he and I would have gotten to be friends, particularly at that time frame, because he was a good old boy, in a small town. Crystal City in Festus, Missouri was 4,000 people.
Yeah.
But he and I got to be really good friends. We got along very, very well. And he would always say to me, you know what? Problem ain't a problem to let hound dogs biting on your ankle. Okay, I got it. And so that's what I try to do with this analogy. And it's one where, you know, folks say, gee, it's not really a big deal and it's no big problem because, you know, only a very small portion of the police really have issues and have problems and do bad things. And most of the police are really good people. And I agree with that. Most of the police are really good people and they're good folks trying to do a really hard job. However, what that fails to take into account is this, that it only takes a small percentage to do major damage. And here's what how the analogy goes. Let's say that a small percentage is 5%. Nah, let's say 3%. And you say, okay, 3%, small percentage, you don't really have to worry about that. No big deal. Well, suppose I said to you that I'm going to set up in a room in a building 100 cans, and under three of those cans, 3%, there's going to be enough explosives to blow you, the building, and the entire block up. And every day you have to go into that room and pick up one of those cans. And when you pick up the can, it's on a pressure switch, and that triggers the explosion. Now, there's only 3% of the cans, got a bomb under them. The cans are rotated and shifted every day, so you can't find one can and go in and pick it up every day. How do you feel when you walk into that room and have to pick up one of those cans? Not very good, do you?
No. Just palm sweat just thinking about it.
Yeah, but that's a small percentage. That's right. A small percentage.
Yeah, I think that is so. It's such a good illustration. What is your other analogy?
So if you have time, people talk about, okay, well, white privilege, and you know, they say, well, gee, there's no such thing, and I don't have that, and I'm not prejudiced, and I didn't do any of those bad things, and I really don't understand what you're talking about. So here's how I explain white privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we are playing baseball, the World Series, 7-game series. You have to win 4 games out of 7, right? Now, there's a white team and a black team. For the first 3 games of the series, the white team gets to have 8 strikes before they're out. They get 2 balls for a walk. The black team gets 8 balls for a walk, 2 strikes for an out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those are the rules. So for the first 3 games, we play under those rules and those conditions. And now the white team is up 3-0. Going into game 4, you come up as a rookie and get added to the white team. Now, you weren't there for the first 3 games. You had nothing to do with that. You didn't set those rules. You may even think those rules are horrible and horrendous and were unfair. But going into game 4, we now say to ourselves, oh, that was horrible. We need to stop doing that. Mm-hmm. So we're all going to play by the same rules. Everybody gets 3 strikes for an out, 4 balls for a walk. And now, because we're playing by the same rules and everybody plays by the same rules, it's fair. And you have a chance to win the series, don't you? I'm up 3-0. You got to win the next 4 games. Isn't that fair?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. You didn't have anything to do with it. You didn't cause it, but you're on the team that definitely has the advantage. That's all white privilege is.
Well, and I'm going to throw something in there, a little red herring.
Sure.
When you were the rookie that joined the team, did you speak up and say the rules aren't fair?
Well, even if you speak up.
Right. But I guess the reason I'm throwing that in there is only because there's a lot of white people that come into the game and they realize it's not fair, but they don't say it's not fair. They just keep playing.
True. That is true. And don't misunderstand me. I don't dislike white people.
I know.
That's not what I'm saying. It's just trying to illustrate what it is. It's just an advantage in your favor. That's all it is. It doesn't say that you willfully or intentionally necessarily have done anything. To your point, yes, sometimes there are those who, yes, willfully and intentionally, they leverage and take advantage of it. But whether you do that or not, you still have the advantage.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's funny because I think the term white privilege, it just makes people kind of automatically have a reaction to it. But there are lots of kinds of privilege. There are.
Oh, there, that is true.
There's financial proof. And I think when you start saying that and you start realizing it's not like skin color is the only privilege that exists for people. There's financial privilege. There's body type privilege. There's all kinds of, but for whatever reason, white privilege really makes people kind of polarized.
Yes, you're absolutely right. It's one of those, it's the words, it's trigger words. And when I can, I try to avoid saying it because I get and understand why they're trigger words. I get it.
Yeah. Well, one last question along these lines for you, and something I wondered. Another thing you hear a lot is, well, haven't we gotten so much better? And you kind of answered this with your baseball analogy. Like, getting better is not necessarily, just bringing things up to the fair line doesn't necessarily actually make it fair. But, how would you answer the question, having experienced America as a Black man for your lifetime, how would you, from what you saw in your college days to now and to what's going on with all of the unrest now, how would you answer someone that says that? Well, haven't we gotten so much better?
Well, yes, we have. You are absolutely right. We have gotten much better. But that still doesn't mean that we're perfect, and it still doesn't mean that the issues have entirely and completely gone away. Mm-hmm. There are still issues and problems that we need to deal with and that we have to work through and grope with. Compared to, and it's always relative, because what my children go through and have lived with, it's completely and totally different from what I went through and what I live with. And you probably remember when we, on your other podcast, Lamont said that himself. He said, well, probably Wayne and I got totally different experiences. But at the same time, my experience compared to the experience of my parents and my grandparents, okay, was worlds different. But still does not mean that it's all over and it's all done. And that kind of goes back to, we just because it's better doesn't mean that it's perfect and that we should stop. Right. There still is a long way to go and a lot that needs to be done. And I'll be fair and honest and say I get it, and I understand the frustration that some white people have, because I get it and I understand it. But the reality is, it's still a problem and an issue that we have to deal with. And it goes back to the, you know, it ain't a problem to the hound dogs biting you on your ankle. That's why you don't. Yep. That's why you don't see it. And that's why you don't feel it. You don't see it. You don't feel it. And again, I understand the frustrations. I understand I get it. I understand it.
The analogy of a webinar I was on recently was, it's like for white people, a lot of them who haven't been paying attention, and hey, I'm no better. I'm not painting myself as a saint here. It's like the lights were turned on and it hurts your eyes because, it's just like, okay, but wait it out. Like keep going, you know, to your point, it doesn't mean that we're done. It's like one foot in front of the other. Just keep going. Keep understanding and making progress.
Yeah. And to your point earlier, I have been blessed and fortunate, and I've had a really good life, and I'm not complaining and crying about what I have been able to do and what I have been able to achieve, because I have been blessed and had some great experiences. And back to your point, because of some of the things I've been able to do and accomplish, understand privilege from the perspective of, I have some privileges like you talked about, like financial privilege. Okay. I get it. But it doesn't mean that it's any less hurtful for the person who does not have it.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It has been So much fun to talk to you again. And believe me, your storytelling was just awesome. And I knew it would be because I've heard you tell stories before and they're great. And I just appreciate you taking the time to be on today and to take us through your story of entrepreneurship, which, like I said, is always fascinating to me, and give us your perspective as a Black man in America. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time and I appreciate the opportunity. And it's always, like I say, fun and enjoy always talking to you. And I do want to stress and emphasize that, you know, I'm not bashing white people.
Oh, God.
And we've all got issues and problems and concerns that we've got to deal with. But I think it's good when you have an opportunity, and I applaud you and appreciate you for giving me this opportunity, because I think a large part of what will help us get through many of these things is having conversations like this. You know, for you and I to, you know, 3 months ago, I didn't know you. And now we're at a point where we can have a conversation like this. It's the one-on-one, one-off opportunities like this for, you know, two people to come together and get meeting of the minds and understand each other that helps us move just a little bit farther down the path. And that's how things are going to get better.
I agree. I think it's that understanding. It's that, okay, what have you been through? I don't know that. I will never see through that lens. And vice versa, you mentioned not seeing through the lens of being a woman. I mean, we all have those perspectives.
Yep. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Wayne, so much.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, Megan. It's been an absolute pleasure and a joy, and certainly hope that this has been what you wanted.
Oh, of course, 100%. Thank you for listening. Let's keep this conversation rolling. For questions and comments, find us on Facebook, Instagram, at Dismantling Normal. Visit our website, dismantlingnormal.com, for the show notes and extra links. See you next time. Have a great day, guys.